exactly do you mean by that? That's what I want to. I'm social dissension.
Well, he implies that with this individualism, there was, I think, more competition, family disputes.
I don't think so. If the individual who got the land became prosperous, the people accepted the fact that he, through his own effort, made it prosperous. They may envy his prosperity. If that is social dissension, it is real envy and jealousy. That he, through his effort, he has the money. And he is better off. But, on the other hand, he could turn around and say, well, you had the same opportunity. I became prosperous because I worked hard and I developed. Why do you want to envy me? I mean, the envy came in when you found that a particular family had very large, you know, acres of land, and that possibly the children did no work and they threw on the ancestral inheritance. That's why I suppose they got, we are getting rid of the Nindagamas. That's the reason given. I can't subscribe to the fact that the new system in any way brought
greater
social dissension.
Well, that's that as far as Leech is concerned. I was able to go through...
Who's this Leech? I'm sorry, I did not read his book. There was a Leech in the civil service.
Not that fellow. It was a social anthropologist from Cambridge. He's holding a very high position in Cambridge.
Uh-huh.
He worked in Burma, did some free work there, then came and lived for about 6 months in this village. And it's really what we call a case study. But misled and misinformed.
Misinformed.
By whom? By the
villagers. By the villagers themselves. And he hadn't the means to check it up by going to other people. I mean, whatever information that was given to him, he should have checked it up, say, with the GA. He could have gone to the government agent and say, look here, this is the information I have got. Will you please check it up for us? Evidently, he has failed to do that. He has based all his views on the information he got in the village itself. And the villager can exaggerate and distort.
Anyway, I'd like to raise a few other sort of general aspects.
Is that my paper or?
Yes.
I think some of it is mine, isn't it, sir?
Yes, this one.
Sorry. I got two.
That's right. About D.S. himself and his colonization scheme.
Yes.
Did you feel that there was a certain element of romanticism here, going back to the past and building up a sturdy peasant yeomanry, trying to do what Parakram Bahu and others did?
What is it?
Sort of going back to the past, you see, the traditional Sinhalese system, which was rice agriculture, trying to revive this. And build up a peasant.
A prosperous peasantry.
Yes.
That was the whole idea. Mm-hmm. He felt that the peasant was made a pauper by various circumstances beyond his control. With a foreign economy coming in. He felt the whole peasantry had been pauperized. Well, he wanted to re-establish them on a modern basis, where they will have sufficient means to live a fairly comfortable life, without anxiety, without want.
Mm-hmm. No, recently there has been questioning of this policy, you see, on the grounds that it couldn't keep pace with population growth, that it was uneconomic, and that it would have been more economical to have spent that money on putting up, say, industries and other things which have brought a greater return, which could have been then dissipated, diffused to the
public. That is a very modern view. Mm-hmm. I mean, industrial development at that time really wasn't thought of. And Mr. Senanayake himself was an agriculturalist. And he said the peasant must have the means to establish himself as a prosperous peasant. The city population he ignored. He said, well, they can fend for themselves. I am out to protect the unprotected. The person who had not got the necessary equipment to protect himself. The sophisticated peasant, the sophisticated urban dweller very often look after himself. But the unfortunate peasant has no protector at all, and he must be protected.
Regarding V.S. himself and his method of working, it is commonly said that he was not a man who read widely, or even when looking at a specific problem, relied on minutes, but preferred the conversation with the officer concerned.
Very much discussion. In the field particularly, he wanted to see things and discuss things, not on paper.
But on the other hand, I have some evidence that he always read administrative reports and diaries and kept an eye on people. Did he do that? Read officers?
Well, very often he got his own secretary to read out reports. Mm-hmm. And very often he asked me when I got, Richard, will you please read this out? And very often discussed it.
But if he was, say, keeping an eye on diaries, that shows that he was willing to do paperwork too.
Oh, he had to do paperwork and he did it. There's no question. Only he tried to minimize it by getting others' help too. I mean, his private secretaries or secretaries may read a whole report and digest it for him.
Taking some other sort of odds and ends.
I mean, he did not like so much of paperwork. I mean, he liked things in pill form, so that he could give the decision. Very much possibly like Churchill too, although he read a lot. He also liked a short memorandum, possibly on one page, but you can say he read 10 pages.
Can you recall how Frank Stockdale, who was your boss for a little while, got on with D.S. and F.R. Senayake and the leading politicians?
I believe he had the ear of the leading political people and tried to accommodate their views as far as possible. He was an extremely able administrator and tried his utmost to make agriculture popular. Okay. Not in the sense that you wanted to do away with the capitalist. I mean, he had no idea of doing that. He wanted to make the peasant a modern agriculturalist, improve his own methods, and see that he got more from his land. Yes.
How about Woods and the politicians? Wilfred Woods.
Got on with you.
I thought he was a tough chap.
He was able. Mm-hmm. He was able possibly to outmaneuver in his own way. But he got on very well with it. They had faith in
him. The civil servants, wasn't there a feeling that Woods was not protecting the financial rights of the civil servants?
Civil service, Woods really had the ear of the governor far more than the colonial secretary and the civil service. In that sense, the civil service took him, rather disliked his methods of work. They felt that he was out to undermine the influence of the service, which held real power and authority in the country. And the colonial secretary, I think, felt that. Some colonial secretaries,
Fletcher.
Definitely.
Fletcher felt that.
I don't
was
know,
it in Fletcher's Fletcher, time or in
no, no.
Thompson's time?
Thompson's, Tittle, a number of them felt that he was trying to undermine the authority of the civil service.
Somewhere I picked up the idea that 1931, when he had this new constitution and everything was a bit of a state of flux, Woods saw to it that his powers were defined and so that the politicians couldn't encroach on it. Whereas the chief secretary didn't take that much care.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Well, as I told you, Woods was extremely clever. And he consolidated his own authority at the expense of others. Not deliberately, I wouldn't say that, but he had certainly, he felt that the civil service occupied a place which it should not occupy. And he felt as head of the treasury that he should have far more authority so far as finance was concerned than the colonial secretary. Because there was a time when the colonial secretary could overrule even the head of the treasury.
Was he rather niggardly with regard to the financial rights of the civil servants? Did he have a, especially in 31 over the transition period, did he define as such that the civil servants got very few compensation benefits?
Difficult to say that, whether he certainly was rather unhappy about the influence that the service had in the administration of the country. And he felt that as financial secretary, that so far as finance is concerned, that his authority should be supreme, put it that way.
I wonder whether this factor was responsible for his quarrel with L.J.B. Turner. He wouldn't have this Turner's
system. Yeah. Maybe, quite possible.
Turning to something completely different, in your last interview, you mentioned the fact that when you were a small boy, someone prohibited you from opening an umbrella when you were going through an estate. Was it you personally or was it general, this estate owner?
The estate planter. The planter.
Uh-huh.
Oh, the planter. European planter.
Here, in Mathalaya?
Yes, Mathalaya, everywhere.
No,
not in my case.
Oh.
Individual. But people came and complained to father and others. And they said, what's the meaning of this? You just ignore them and go where you like.
That's just a small point I want to check up on. Looking back...
Because the planter felt that the prestige that the average villager showed the Rata Mahatma when he saw even the elephant keeper would get down, the man would close his umbrella and show him that respect. Well, he felt that this gentleman too ought to get the same respect. The coolies may have done that on his estate, but not the average villager. The GA got that respect because he was the government agent and the government official, but not the average plant.
Looking at your compatriots in the civil service in the 20s and 30s, especially the British one, did you feel that they had a sense of mission, or was it just another job?
Depends individuals. Mm-hmm. Depends on the individuals.
Then there were some with what one might call a dedication.
Dedication, liberal views, and really wanted to serve the country.
On the other hand, even those without a sense of mission might have been quite conscientious in their
approach to their work. Mm-hmm. They were never slackers in that. When work had to be done mm-hmm. under those regulations, they were earnest workers.
Mm-hmm. But without a sense of mission, some of them.
Mission, I mean, in that form, that they were missionaries. No, that they had to do that work which was given to them earnestly. He had to be governed, and he had to remain there.
The colored man.
The men in the colonies, the colored man, which came there.
Now, looking at chaps like Freeman and Brain, have you any idea what inspired them in this dedication? Was it some book they had read, or...?
No, it's, I think, a sheer sense of right and wrong, mm-hmm. which inspired them. They felt that they were there not to feather their own nests, but to help these people to get on their feet.
What about the question of self-government? Say, in the time of Manning's reforms, did these Britishers realize that self-government was going to come in their lifetime?
Very difficult to say. But they felt that things were going to move forward. And that popular, liberal mm-hmm. administration was going to replace gradually.
And now this was the time when Gunasinghe was beginning his trade union activities in Colombo. Have you any idea what attitude the secretariat had to trade union?
Well, as far as my experience goes, the first strike that Mr. Gunasinghe engineered or brought about was in the customs when I was working there. And I cannot say he was popular. Naturally, they said, this wretched fellow is creating trouble. And he certainly organized labor. And it wasn't very popular, naturally, with the proprietors who wielded power entirely exclusively without interference from any kind of labor organization.
You said he engineered it, but wasn't it more a spontaneous outbreak which he took control of?
No, I think he really was the first man to organize labor and to give them a voice collectively, so that they may assert their rights.
You said that as a junior in the customs, then you told your boss or the colonial secretary something about it. You submitted a memo about the strike?
Yes, I told them. Mm-hmm. I told them that it was very necessary to have a board of arbitration, that these disputes were bound to arise. I told them that labor had a very unfair deal from the conditions I saw when I went round the warehouses. And if there were genuine grievances, that there must be an organization which could intervene and give relief. Therefore, I said a board of arbitration might be of very great help.
What was their reaction to this advice?
Well, ultimately, that so far as that strike was concerned, it was arbitration that brought about a settlement.
But didn't they set up a permanent board?
No, I suggested, I said, there should be a permanent home, so that they may know that they can go to that boy. I suggested the two, really, the principal of a collector at that time, Sir Prem Thero.
And he was amenable, was he?
The one? He listened to me. I can't say he was amenable. Right. He was very liberal in his own way, very kind, but very great imperialist. You see, at that stage, in the colonies, labor as such was looked upon as a coolie. And his master's word must be law. Mm-hmm. And what he says must be accepted.
What about Gunasinghe's reputation of having a band of thugs with him and making money? Wasn't there a...
There was. Oh, it's true. That he was out to get power. That he was out to get money.
But wasn't this talk sometimes fostered by other Ceylonese who didn't like what he was doing?
May have been jealousy that he had created a position for himself amongst labor, that he was respected by them. Mm-hmm. Now I know, whenever he went to the Queen's Hotel, those days, all the waiters used to respect him. And naturally people looked with envy, look at these fellows, all these fellows running after him.
Did he ever employ the communal cry?
What is
it? You know, the try to raise, put the Sinhalese against the...
No, I don't. Not that I know. I can't. Because in the customs strike, possibly 74% were Tamil laborers too, who were working in the docks and various places, in the warehouse, handling of cargo.
Turning to a completely different sphere, something which you know a lot about really, in the 20s for instance, on what basis did the government choose headmen, both the Rattanahatmeyers and the middle and lower ones?
Well, very often the man who worked under the GA in the Kachari and who had a particular prestige in the district and who was efficient in his work, got the job.
Mm-hmm. But was it
not entirely based on the family alone, but he had to have that influence and capacity to do a particular job of work.
Mm-hmm. But speaking generally, especially with regard to the higher post, wasn't it kept within family circles partly because of natural hereditary influence?
Particularly the old headman system. Mm-hmm. The Ratamahatmaya, the Korala, the Arachi. Not the other government services. There I came to examination and merit. But here, prestige counted a lot. Mm-hmm. And the family background. Mm-hmm. That is the feudal system, the relic of the feudal system.
And didn't, if I may raise this topic, caste was a count in the sense that they didn't wish to uphold caste, but naturally he had to be of the predominant caste in the area.
Yeah.
To what extent could the Kachari Mudaliar, as distinct from the district person, have influenced all these nominations, especially the lower ones?
The Kachari Mudaliar was treated as the chief advisor of the government. As such, even the Ratamahatmeyas, the headman, everyone had a regard for him. And he was able to exploit that particular position in various ways. Mm-hmm. Not that the GA was entirely guided by him, mm-hmm. but the people felt here was the chief advisor. And he could influence the GA in various ways.
There is a theory among Ceylonese, nowadays and in previous decades, that most of these headmen, the Ratamahatmyas, the Vidhanayarachis, Koralas, Kachari Mudaliyas, were very sort of obsequious and always put up what the GA wanted. And therefore their views are not independent views.
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. There were certain people who were thoroughly independent and gave their views for what they were worth and discussed with the GAs intelligently. Mm-hmm. Others, of course, were absolutely obsequious and wanted to cater to the desires of the boss.
Mm-hmm. Did you find this was so even when you were GA in Anuradhapuram?
Well, naturally they wanted to accommodate me as far as possible. But I had a number of RMs and others who were very frank with me, and I encouraged them to. Mm-hmm. And they never hesitated to give me good advice. Mm-hmm. I mean, when the advice, if I felt the advice was wrong, well, I disregarded it.
In fact,
now there was a case where at a land kachari, I had selected people of a particular caste, what they called a lower caste. And there were protests, sir, if you give that land, no others will go near that land. I said, well, they're welcome to do it, but I'm going to give the land, they're landless. And they must survive too, not the others only. All sections of the community must survive. It is their land. They are citizens of Ceylon.
In fact, with regard to this view about subservient headmen, I'm inclined to think that especially in the older days, a good proportion of them were not so much subservient, but very influential in the sense that they had an influence on the GA decision.
Oh, tremendous. Tremendous. GA consulted them. I mean, very few GAs would do a thing without consulting the Ratamahatmya in regard to his district work. He'll always say, Harambhav, what do you think of this? Is this correct? And he would often accept advice too. Because they were people of prestige in the country. And they knew the country. They knew the habits. They knew the customs. Some of them may have been reactionary. But yet, they said, well, this is the system that is prevalent, and in accordance with that, we give you this advice. Mm-hmm.
Did some of them, especially the middle ranks, use this prestige and their position to increase their own family landholding? Because when one looks at some of our leading politicians or leading, shall I say, some of our wealthy family, they have originated from Vidhanarachi families or from that layer, you see.
That may be possibly, that may apply to the low country, but not in the up country, except very few. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the up country, the landowning class really had got their land by royal grants. Mm-hmm. And they had a prestige of their own.
What about oppression in general? Because, you know, this Chena Mohandirams, all these special departmental officers, didn't they?
They got the opportunity, and they made use of it.
But wasn't this the government's fault? They paid them too little.
Even if they were paid more, I'm not sure whether they wouldn't have
done it. Inbred.
Not inbred, I would say, well, get as much as you can and be rich. Uh-huh. If they had been paid better, possibly there would have been less abuse. Uh-huh. I mean, even a Ratamahatmya was paid 6 rupees a month. But of course, the rupee, the purchasing capacity of the rupee was so much that he, I mean, the Ratamahatmya, they were worried about his salary. is a prestige that he had.
60 rupees a month, when?
Oh, that was in 1910, mm-hmm. I believe, yes.
I'm also interested in the role of the headman in the elections to the state council, 31, 36. Didn't they have a great influence on the mass vote?
Depended on the area and the headman concerned. Mm-hmm. In the urban areas, no. Mm-hmm. In the rural areas, yes. Up to a point. Particularly in a place like the NCT.
So that means if you won over the majority of the headman, you would really get a mass of block votes.
Depended on the area. Mm-hmm. Now in the 1956 elections, the headman had no. He had no. They had outgrown the influence of the headman.
In 31, there's an interesting conflict, shall I say, or contest in Dumbara between Kindersley and A. Ratnayagar.
Yes.
I wonder what role the headman played there. Because they would have been in a rather cleft stick, you see, wouldn't they? Kindersley, their old boss.
Yes, yes. I think the headman possibly supported Kindersley. But certainly the RMs in that area did. But they were not able to carry that vote.
What about your brother Bernard? I presume you had a natural support from the headman in this area, in 36.
Well, I know because my parents, my grandparents held office and the family was fairly well known, and Bernard himself had a very good record of public service. And naturally, they said, well, we must give the vote to this person.
I'm not thinking of so much of these traditional areas, but other areas, say, borderline areas like Ruanwell and Kurunagala, that area, where really the issue was fairly close. Didn't sometimes a headman favor a particular candidate, their own candidate, say, by the way they registered voters?
Possibly they did. It depended on the candidates themselves to check up the list.
But did the candidates do that?
Bhavan? Well, they should have done that. Mm-hmm. I mean, now, in a place like Ratnayak versus Kindersley, well, Ratnayak obviously checked up the list and knew exactly who should have been registered. But in preparing the list, headman had a tremendous lot of influence, and they could have excluded certain people, unless other opponent was vigilant enough.
The GA couldn't check that.
GA couldn't. How could the GA? Unless protest came to him, and he checked it up.
Did you have to run any of these elections, 36? 31?
Yes.
You were in the land settlement, I think, in 31.
Yes, I was in the land settlement. I presided. Oh yes, Anuradhapura. In 1947, 1945, I ran, I was GA there. Pulankama contested, Poliade contested, they all won.
Pardon?
They won.
Pulankama?
Oh, yes.
What helped him to win there?
His own prestige. Family. Mm-hmm. Had very high prestige.
So in that sense, he would have had the support of the headman?
Oh, definitely. 100%. He resigned his office as Ratnayagar in contest.
What about undue pressure by the headman? Some people say that these are allegations, right? That they destroyed culverts and bridges and things and prevented.
Very exaggerated. Very little of that happened, certainly not in Anuradhapura and that area. They say in certain areas that was very, very unlikely. Because it affected all the voters. If you destroy a bridge, well, all the voters were handicapped by that. If you destroyed a culvert.
No, but if it was, say, a particular caste, village, they sort of destroyed their...
Threatened them and say, well, don't come on. May have happened, particularly in the south. Particularly in the south, in certain areas.
Not a thuggery there.
So I hear. Mm-hmm. So I heard.
If I may raise a sort of a personal question really, and with regard to your brother, I don't know anything about him, and I was wondering if you could give us a thin picture of his leanings and his ideas.
Well, he was at Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
He qualified as a BCA, mm-hmm. got a second class honours, and then joined Mahatma Gandhi, went to India,
mm-hmm.
and was locked up in prison with Nehru,
mm-hmm.
his sister, and in the letters that Nehru wrote to his sister, Mrs. Hathi Singh, he mentioned it. How
whose sister?
Nehru's sister.
Nehru's sister. So that means he was already, I mean, very, very much a nationalist.
Very much a nationalist, and a nationalist based on the Gandhi background,
mm-hmm.
on the Gandhian background.
Then that would imply that he didn't have the, shall I say, the Philip Gunawardena, NM type of Marxism.
No, poor.
But wouldn't he have been influenced by socialism as distinct from Marxism?
Socialism. As I told you, he was really a disciple of Mahatma Gandhi and Nehru. He took the cue from them. And he was a nationalist nationalist based on those, the ideologies of those two.
So when he came and got elected to the state council, with which group of politicians was he moving then, in the late 30s and early 40s? I mean, there was no real party then.
Yes, there was no real party, really depended on leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he belonged to any party at all. He discussed any topic on its merits.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering whether he was, say, closer to Vandanayaka as distinct from B.S.?
Well, at one stage, he who started this...
SLP.
Huh? SLP, yes.
He crossed the floor with
Bhagavad? Yes, yes.
What made him...
do that? It's very difficult to say that because he disagreed with certain... You know, he felt that possibly DS and company were out to maintain capitalism as such and wanted a more socialistic move and thought possibly that he would go with Banda and organize a new party. And that there was possibly too much family influence in one group.
Mm-hmm. There was a Sennag. Almost a click there, no?
Mm-hmm. There was that impression.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's about time you broke it.
But even Sir John gave it a flash in the premier stakes.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes.
But what surprises me is that Bernard left Bandaranaike in 56, because if he didn't, he would have become a minister.
Because he accommodated the communists. Well, he told me. He says, let's fight on our own, don't bring in the communists. It's on that basis that he left. He says, I don't want the communists.
That's Philip Frey.
Yes, I don't want them to come. We can win on our own. And I want you to fight.
That's very interesting that he was confident that they could win.
Oh! He told me, Vice Banda. Definitely told him. Just a minute.
Who were the original members of the SLFP?
I can't tell you. No. I can't tell you. And contested the seat. Of course, the Tamil vote solidly went to him. As
here.
Gandhi's disciple.
Oh, I see. Tamil vote here.
Block. On block.
In that case, even in 56, he would have been finding it difficult to accommodate himself to some of Bandaranaike's policies.
Yes. He told Bandaranaike, very definitely, don't do this. We can fight on our own. But if you bring others in, I'm going to resign.
Now, what about the communal aspect of Bandaran Naik's policy? That might have conflicted with his Gandhian connections.
Well, he couldn't subscribe to that. Mm-hmm. He couldn't subscribe.
In fact, I was interested in reading, when I read, I think it's J.L.C. Fernando's review of Bandaran Naik, or it may be Tasi Vitas's book, mentioning this continuous interference with the police and the others in 56, 57, 58. You weren't here, were you?
57, I was here.
Did you feel that the politicians were interfering too much in the administration and in police activity?
Tremendous. Since 1956, I hope. Absolutely. We progressed like the cow's tail, I must say, in that way.
Progress like?
The cow's tail, I said. Because indiscipline, interference. And I know the police, I had, had a very, very difficult time, and I used to get complaints from police, even when I was High Commissioner.
In India.
Saying this interference is impossible for us to carry out.
If, and J.L.C. Fernando mentions the fact that once at the cabinet meeting, you know, Osman Lisilva lost his temper with the Prime Minister.
Right.
Is that correct?
Oh, it's correct. And I heard. And
so in that sense, he was being quite courageous because he was undermining his own position, wasn't he?
Very courageous. Indeed, too courageous for his own benefit anyway. But he did fight the cause of the police, very stout-hearted. And several officers too told him that he was having a dog's life. But yet, he had fought hard to establish the, or maintain the prestige of the police.
Listen, going back to something else, I would also like your picture of your appraisal of Fraser, because you knew him quite well, didn't you?
Oh, yes, brother. I had the highest regard. Mm-hmm. Have you read his life by
Ward?
Yes. Well, I've subscribed to most of it.
Oh, I see.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely, he was the most liberal mind. He changed a lot. It possibly started with the imperial background. Then as time went on, he became absolutely socialist. And so far as color was concerned, had no regard for it.
Mm-hmm. But what about the question of liberalizing our political institutions then?
Very much.
While he was in Trinity?
Even when he was in Trinity, he wanted the liberal form of government to come. I mean, our school was liberalized. I mean, he wanted the prefects and the others to govern, and not the teaching faculty. Mm-hmm. Mind you, at that stage, there was that imperial touch. But as time went on, he simply changed completely.
Because there are some other Syrians who really seemed to, I mean, I don't know him at all. I'm talking about some of the older people who dislike him and say that he was an imperialist and all.
No. That is not correct. As I told you, at one time he may have been a liberal imperialist, not a reactionary imperialist. But he was a friend of Nehru's, he was a friend of Mahatma Gandhi, C.F. Andrews, all of them came and stayed with him. C.F. Andrews was a personal friend of his. Well, I remember when I went to the Colonial Secretary's office in connection with something or other to interview the PACS. He was offered a chair, I wasn't. He at once pulled a chair and said, sit down, Richard. And as he came out, he said, these chaps left manners.
This was when you were junior?
Yes, junior prefect. He's the prefect. These chaps left manners.
There's another personality I was interested in, Fletcher. How was he popular with this leading Sudanese politician?
Yes, I believe he was.
Why?
He was liberal-minded.
Oh.
And he wanted the progress that was being made to be maintained. Mm-hmm. He did not want to obstruct it.
But there are other people who say that he was rather two-faced.
Two?
Two-faced.
Two-faced, I can't tell you. He may have been a bit timid, but I don't know. I can't tell you because I did not know him. I mean, from what I know him, he accommodated the politicians and they were fond of him.
In fact, that was a problem.